Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, reporter Cleo Krage on the native Iowan who made headlines this week as the Facebook whistleblower. Also, we'll meet a new MacArthur Fellow who is a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. But let's start, first of all, with a quick update on COVID. The national outlook has improved considerably in recent weeks. Hospitalizations, new case reports falling since the middle of last month. But we still remember more than 700,000 coronavirus deaths have now been reported nationwide. We've heard this week about those reports from Alaska, by far the most recent cases per capita in the country, in Alaska. Conditions improving rapidly in the South, which experienced that horrible summer case surge. Let's focus on Iowa with Natalie Krebs, our health reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Ben.
Hi. While the rate of new coronavirus infections reported to be declining nationwide, they remain pretty high here in Iowa. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so they are remaining high in Iowa. You know, last week we saw nearly 10,000 new infections reported in the past week. That's followed by the last couple of weeks, more than 10,000 new cases were reported. Remember, this virus kind of comes in waves, hits different parts of the country at different times. So we saw the South previously before the Midwest kind of light up. We saw all those cases come through. We saw all the hospitalizations. They're going down now. The Midwest case counts still remain high. Experts say that could possibly change starting next week.
Why next week?
Basically, that's just what they're seeing with the waves going through. So once again, you know, the South, the Southern states, you know, saw waving cases before us, started before the Midwest. They're now going down. And so now we're looking at possibly the Midwest is at that point where cases will start going down next week. We kind of hit that peak. We're hoping it will plateau now, and then things will start to shift downwards.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what Iowans could be doing that they haven't been doing in the past weeks to really fend off these successive waves of the virus.
Right. So experts say there's actually a number of reasons why cases have gone up and kind of stayed up this time. You know, this wave has gone on longer than other previous waves. One of the reasons is that mask usage is lower in Iowa as compared to national numbers. You know, mask usage in Iowa is about 21% of residents are using masks compared to about 41% of the nation. Another reason why Iowans are very mobile, they're moving around the state quite a bit, you know, that really spreads the virus around. The other thing that's really affecting this as well is vaccination rates in Iowa are still quite low. So, you know, we're still seeing a lot of people who need to get vaccinated out there. And we're seeing a lot of people who have never been infected with the virus. So basically you combine those two things together and there's a lot of potential people who could still get infected with COVID-19.
I think I heard in your reporting, one expert put it very simply that we are very reactive, not proactive towards this pandemic.
Yeah, Americans in general, and that includes Iowans, are very reactive to this pandemic. So basically, that's what we've seen with other waves. Cases go way up, and then people start social distancing more, people start wearing masks more, and then they go down, and then people feel more comfortable. They start to open up, they go out more, they stop wearing their masks as much, cases go up. So that's sort of the way we've been with this pandemic. It's just been kind of reacting to high cases, and then we get a little bit better with mitigation strategies until things go down again.
Ending on a high note in terms of proactive work here, the Meskwaki Nation's Tribal Health Center, you reported, getting national recognition for its vaccination efforts. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, so the Meskwaki Nation got an award, a national award, the Heroes in Health Award. It's the most prestigious award from the National Indian Health Board this week, basically. You know, the Meskwaki Nation has always been ahead of Iowa with this vaccination rates. You know, they had about 70% of their residents, those who live on the settlement, vaccinated back in April. Now they're saying that's close to 90%. You know, They've done a number of things. You know, they've offered incentives for vaccinations using those Visa gift cards to really get more people vaccinated. They were also able to get the vaccine earlier through the federal government. That's an option for them as a federally recognized tribe, and really push that vaccine for its residents. And this week we saw they were recognized nationally for their vaccination efforts.
That's amazing. Just under 90% of the settlement's eligible population fully vaccinated. Well, hats off to the Meskwaki Nation here in Iowa. Natalie Krebs, our IPR health reporter, thanks for the update. Until next time.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. Well, last week, relatively few knew the name Frances Haugen. This week, she is known around the world. On Tuesday, Frances Haugen made international headlines as the Facebook whistleblower. When she testified before a congressional subcommittee, she told that Senate panel in alarming detail that Facebook had ignored its harmful effects on young people in pursuit of profit. Mark Zuckerberg has rebutted the claims. It was last month that Haugen, who is a former Facebook product manager, leaked a trove of internal company documents to the Wall Street Journal that showed Facebook's inner workings. Frances Haugen is a native Iowan. She grew up in Iowa City, where she attended public schools. She also went on to graduate from Harvard. Cleo Krage is a reporter with the Iowa City Press-Citizen. She's been researching and writing about Haugen's background, which is of interest to a lot of people this week. I can only imagine. Cleo, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks.
What more can you tell us about the youth of this remarkable woman who has burst onto the international stage?
Yeah, so we did a bit of research into her background just by looking at newspaper archives from the Iowa City Press-Citizen. We have access to all of them. So she was frequently quoted and written about in her hometown newspaper pretty much from elementary school until she graduated in 2002 from high school. So we learned that she, at age 8, was so concerned about some plans to widen a neighborhood road in Iowa City. She wrote to a U.S. representative saying, "Please don't let them turn Melrose Avenue into a four-lane road. I couldn't walk home from school. Sincerely yours, Frances Haugen." And that was 1993.
At the age of 8. That's amazing.
Yeah. And her mom actually sent that in as a letter to the editor. To the Press-Citizen. And when she was in sixth grade, she was in a handful of geography competitions called Geography Bees. Basically, they quizzed you about geography and you worked with a team to answer questions, like trivia questions about it. And as a sixth grader, she was quoted in the Press-Citizen saying she, you know, geography was a hobby for her. And she said, quote, "I'm more into gardening because I want to be a biologist and grow food to feed the world, or I want to be a lawyer and then become a politician."
Wow. So aspirations from a very early age. Also, I see you in your reporting, one of seven students when she was in high school at West High in Iowa City to win first place in a statewide engineering competition.
Yeah. Yeah. She, you know, that was like a science focused competition. She had to answer questions about physics, chemistry and biology. She was also the captain of the policy debate team when she was in high school. And she was named a semifinalist for the Iowa Forensic League State Speech and Debate Tournament in 2002. So that's the year she graduated from West High School, like you said. Before that, for people from Iowa City, she went to Horn Elementary and then Northwest Junior High School. So yeah, by all indications, according to this newspaper trove we've dug into, she was a really active student and community member when she was growing up here.
Cleo, as a reporter, a young journalist, I'm wondering what your thoughts are when you look at this person growing up in a city you're reporting from and report about, that when you look at someone's background, it's very clear. Let me put it this way. It's not a surprise that she did what she did this week, is it?
No, it's the opposite of a surprise. She clearly showed from a young age that she wanted to be an active community member and that she was hungry intellectually for something else.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, since you wrote this article a few days ago, how much traction has it, how much attention has it gained out there compared to other sort of, let's just say, run-of-the-mill things that happen? This is anything but run-of-the-mill when a name from Iowa becomes an internationally known, isn't it?
Yeah, people really cared about this story. I was, you know, to be perfectly honest, a little surprised. It's a story about a girl who loved geography and debate and engineering, you know, and that's the story of probably a lot of kids in Iowa City, but the story got a lot of traction and people seem to care. And I think it shows that it's important for us to keep an eye on what our community members are up to, because, you know, someday they might become a Frances Haugen.
Cleo Craig is a reporter with the Iowa City Press-Citizen talking about her digging into her article on the background of Frances Haugen. Native Iowan, grew up in Iowa City, attended to Iowa City public schools, and became this week known internationally as the Facebook whistleblower. Cleo Craig, until next time, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. They're sometimes called genius grants and are meant to identify all kinds of people, extraordinary people, scientists, artists, entrepreneurs, and others who have demonstrated exceptional creativity and who show promise for important future advances. Writer and radio producer Daniel Alarcón was named a recipient of a 2021 MacArthur Fellowship. And Daniel has a strong Iowa connection. He received a Master of Fine Arts from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop back in 2004. But before we chat with Daniel, let's listen to audio from a short video about him found at the MacArthur Foundation's website, macfound.org. And this is Daniel telling you a little bit about his work.
Stories are how we create community. Stories are how we define who we are. I'm Daniel Alarcón. I'm a writer and radio producer. I think what unites all of my work is a genuine curiosity. I really am interested in people's stories. When I ask people questions, I really want to hear the answers, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction, whether it's print or audio, whether it's English or Spanish. I think it's no accident that the themes that show up in my fiction also show up in my journalism. I've written about gangs in El Salvador. I've written about book piracy in Peru. I've spent a night in Peru's most notorious prison. I've written about criminal justice in California, civil unrest in Chile. One of the core ideas of Rambulante from the beginning has been that geographical boundaries or political borders may be real, but cultural and linguistic boundaries are completely fluid. It makes me super proud to be able to see those stories like living next to each other and being commented upon by people who've never been to those places, but who suddenly feel like they have a connection there.
Daniel Alarcón, welcome to River to River, and congratulations on this incredible award.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be here.
I want to mention that the MacArthur Foundation, of course, underwrites public media, just to get that out there. Daniel, you are an Iowa Writers' Workshop graduate. Tell us about the fiction you write and what themes you like to explore.
Yeah, I was a student at Iowa. I have great memories of Iowa City from 2002 to 2004. And while I was there, I wrote my first collection and part of my first novel. My family's from Peru, and a lot of what I've written about has been dealing with the political violence that sort of was the backdrop of my childhood and adolescence in Peru. So my family moved to the United States in 1980, but on all our trips back, it was like we were constantly being reminded of just how difficult the situation was there. And a lot of that violence forms, you know, my first novel, my first collection. It's all in there.
And when you grow up in the midst of that political violence, in this case in Peru, how does it change a person? How did it change you? How did it shape you?
Well, it shaped me. I mentioned that we moved to the United States. So it was interesting because I feel like I grew up with a kind of survivor's guilt, sort of a sense of always wondering what my life would have been like if we'd stayed. There was no one in Peru who grew up in that time that wasn't affected directly or indirectly by the instability and the violence and the economic calamity that came along with it. I had family members who were very directly affected, who passed away. But just the uncertainty and the anxiety is just a part of life. And I think my work, a lot of it has been trying to understand what those impacts are. I think that, you know, the coming out of those years of violence and those years of political instability, when it seemed like the government itself and the country was on the verge of collapse, gives people a certain cynicism, a certain steeliness, a certain self-reliance too, because you know that you can't necessarily count on the institutions that are there to, you know, ostensibly protect you.
Mm-hmm. In 2012, you co-founded, and I hope I'm getting the pronunciation good. Spanish is not my foreign language. Radio Ambulante.
Ambulante. Yeah, that's pretty good, Ben. That's pretty good.
Thank you. It's a Spanish language podcast, also put out by NPR. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was asked by the BBC to do a radio documentary in Peru, and I loved the idea. My father worked in radio when he was a young man as a soccer announcer in Peru, so this was all just like kind of a dream come true. And I went to Peru and did a bunch of interviews and recorded this documentary. And then when it was edited in London, they took out basically all the interviews that I'd done in Spanish and just included the interviews I'd done in English. And that led me to a question. I was a little bit unhappy about that, but I understood, and I wasn't the editor, so I didn't have any say. But it led me to the question of what would it be like to have a space on in audio that told Spanish language stories in Spanish language, you know, Latin American stories in Spanish. And our elevator pitch at the beginning was simple. It was just, you know, This American Life in Spanish, and everyone would say, oh, that doesn't exist already. And when you think about Latin American culture, you think about great storytellers and the concept of a sobremesa, you know, where everyone's after a meal just telling stories and endless talking and laughter and spitting out tales. And it just seemed crazy to us that it didn't exist. And so my wife and I decided to make it.
Daniel, your work spans multiple mediums and languages. You write fiction, nonfiction. You're in English, Spanish, print, audio. Specifically for our medium that we're using right now, what's unique about telling stories for people's ears?
Ben, I think it's very similar to literature. And I mean this, you know, I'm not trying to be facetious at all. I think when you listen to a great story being told on the air and the voice of the protagonist, it's not dissimilar to reading a great novel. When you feel like the author is whispering in your ear and telling you a story, you know, especially the way we listen to podcasts now, you know, with our earbuds as we walk around town or whatever. It is this, it's a very private and intimate way of transporting a listener to a different world. I love everything about it. I love being able to hear not just the words that people are saying, but the way they're saying it, the silences, the pauses, the laughter, the words they start to say, but stop. I mean, there's just so many. The accents, of course, the vocabulary that's different in every you know, community. I feel like there's so much information you can glean from a voice, from a human voice that you otherwise would never get. That's what I really love about it.
Would you say you were a natural when you started doing this at telling stories in the audio form, or no. Coming from print work, did it take some work to develop that skill?
Well, I don't know if they still do those readings at Prairie Lights.
Yes, they do.
Okay. So, you know, I had an unfortunate sort of like a literary reading voice that, and I was used to speaking in front of people because I'd published by that point a couple of books and done readings, you know, around the country. And so I was like pretty confident, and it was awful. It was awful. I mean, the way you read a piece of fiction to an audience in a bookstore like Prairie Lights is not the same way you carry on a conversation or track a story on for audio, and it shouldn't be, and it took me a little while to recognize that. But man, am I glad I did, because it was bad.
The MacArthur Fellowship Program does not accept applications, and most new fellows learn of their nominations, their awards upon receiving a phone call. Is that how you receive news?
Yeah. I mean, I had no advance warning, no idea, nothing. You know, it was a fine, shocking, beautiful moment. I got a call,
and you actually picked up your phone, because most of us say, "Oh, unrecognized phone number, must be spam."
Yeah, I assumed it was someone trying to sell me a warranty on a car or something. No, but I saw it was a number from Chicago. I didn't recognize the number, so I didn't answer. They called back a few times, and I didn't answer. And then I saw there was an email saying, like, "Hey, we're trying to reach you." And, you know, I figured it was about a Reambulante grant or something that had to do, you know, we worked with, as you mentioned, MacArthur supports public radio in lots of ways. So I thought maybe it had to do with that. I called, and instead of speaking to one person, I was, you know, I called and was in a conference call. And then I was like, "Whoa, what's going on here?" And they were like, "You know, are you in a quiet place? Are you alone?" And I was like, "Yes." And then they told me the news, and it was just a lot of very unprofessional laughter on my part. I could not believe what they were saying. And it was just, it seemed so absurd that I was just couldn't stop laughing.
The current prize is $625,000, paid over 5 years in quarterly installments, no strings attached. And this fellowship is not a reward, it says, for past accomplishment, rather an investment, Daniel, I'm sure you're aware, in a person's originality, insight, and potential. So what will this bundle of money allow you to do that might not have been done otherwise?
That's a great question. I mean, there's very practical things that need to be done. Like, I have two boys that, you know, need to be educated, you know, things like that that are sort of banal and ordinary, and you can't escape them. I think, Ben, money is, as you know, is fungible. And the only way I'm going to make this work for me is if I'm able to turn that money into time. There's no shortage of ideas and projects that I have. It's just a matter of how do I turn that extra money into what it was intended for, which is to free up my schedule so that I can, you know, write that screenplay or go back to that novel or finish that story or immerse myself in a reporting project. You know, there's lots of things that I want to do. There's so many things that I want to do. It's just a matter of clearing the plate so that I can do them. I will say this. I fully intend to take a vacation with my family that I would not have been able to afford otherwise, and maybe another one with just my wife and not the kids.
Well, well-earned vacation, that goes without saying. Daniel Alarcón, recipient of a 2021 MacArthur Fellowship, also a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. All the best to you. Congratulations. Enjoy that well-deserved vacation. And Daniel, we will be waiting for years and years of tremendous projects from you. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben. It was lovely to chat with you.
Coming up after a short break, we'll meet a Pakistani journalist now in residence here in Iowa. That's after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including above and beyond cancer.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's been called the United Nations of Writers. Since 1967, over 1,500 writers from more than 150 countries have spent time in residence at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. Well, another group of established writers from around the world has just arrived in our state to take part in that residency. It lasts through the end of November. In just a moment, we'll hear from the director of the International Writing Program, Christopher Merrill. But first, let's meet one of the 18 writers in the current fall residency. Sanam Maher is a nonfiction writer and a journalist from Pakistan. She covers stories on Pakistan's art and culture, also business, politics, religious minorities, and women. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, also Al Jazeera, among other places. And for her book, A Woman Like Her, which was published in 2018, she investigated the murder of Pakistan's first social media celebrity. Sanam joins us now. Sanam Meher, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to focus mostly on this book. It sounds fascinating and like a real journalistic challenge. Tell us about the subject of your work, A Woman Like Her.
Sure. The book actually came out in the United States last year. And it's the story of a woman who became the first person really in Pakistan to become a social media sensation. She was a young woman who knew how to very cleverly use platforms like Instagram, Twitter. She's been referred to here in the States as the Kim Kardashian of Pakistan. So that kind of gives you a sense of who she was or how she worked. I don't believe she came from the sort of privilege that a Kardashian does, but she was famous for the things that she would post online. We couldn't stop watching her videos, looking at her photographs. And then in July of 2016, she was killed by her brother because he said that he disagreed with the kinds of things she was posting online. And I became very interested in her story and just the reaction that followed after her death. We had a huge number of young men and women who were very saddened by the death. It was scary, it was tragic, but we had an equally large number of people who were very glad that this had happened. And they talked about it in a way where Kandil, this woman, she had been punished for what she had been doing. She'd pushed the envelope too far. She was doing things that aren't accepted in our society or culture. And they were very glad to see her taken down in this terrible way.
In Western culture, many have it, it's hard to understand, but this is an honor killing, so to speak.
It is. We refer to it as an honor killing, which essentially is any crime that takes place when someone believes they have been slighted or they disagree with something you're doing. And it's almost a restore a social order. Honor killings, I believe, like the word is different, but they take place in so many parts of the world. And I think with Kandil in particular, it may be called an honor killing, but what interested me was how have we reached this point where we feel so willing and able to participate in somebody's takedown or for them to be punished in a certain way if we disagree with what they're doing or saying. That to me was the larger story here. How have we reached this point?
Writing a book, researching it on this woman's death, did you as a journalist wrestle with any ethical dilemmas?
Hugely. Kandil was someone, this was a persona that this young woman had created. Kandil wasn't her real name. She had this life before she became famous, which she kept very much under wraps. And I became really intrigued by the idea of in this day and age, when you are such a public personality, how do you manage to keep a secret like your real name, where you come from? She had been married before, she'd had a child. All of these things came to light in the last week of her life, just before she was killed. And she'd never mentioned it. She'd managed to keep us looking at her and interested in her long enough that we didn't even pause to say, who is this woman? Where did she come from? And why can I not stop staring at what she's doing and posting online? So for me, it really was a question of if this person didn't share these details about their life while they had the chance to do so, what gives me the right to do it? And how can I do it in a careful, in a considered way and tell the story of their life?
So how did you solve that dilemma journalistically?
Well, a lot of it came from me deciding that this wasn't just going to be the story of Kandil. She allowed me to tell the story of my generation of Pakistanis that's connected to the world like never before, all from this gadget that we have in our hands. And we're looking at the ways in which people around the world live. We have aspirations to live in certain ways, but we're very much rooted in a place that doesn't allow for those aspirations. And what happens when there is a disconnect between those two things. So I made a rule for myself where anything that I revealed about Kandil's life or the information that I had about her, it had to open up into a larger story about young men and women in Pakistan right now and the things that they're considering, how they live their lives, how we use online spaces, how we consider things like fame or what it means to go viral or to ask for attention. So I sort of had that as a baseline rule that anything I revealed about her had to allow me to tell a bigger story.
Mm-hmm. Was the brother, the perpetrator, the killer in this case, held to account?
Yes, he has been convicted. He's in jail. There was a trial. And actually, after Kandil's death, legislation around honor killings was changed in Pakistan. He's convicted.
Mm-hmm. Next week, October 14th, on Thursday, you'll be speaking before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, related to this investigation work that you did, right? What will you focus on?
The talk, what I really wanted to do was to open up a conversation around themes that came up with this book and the book I'm working on next, hopefully, fingers crossed. And a lot of stuff that has come up in the wake of Kandil's death, how young women in Pakistan, I see them having conversations around sex or consent or issues of, we had the Me Too movement really sort of pick up pace in Pakistan. And Kandil really was sort of our first test case. She'd had an incident while she was alive, and that sort of really propelled her to another level of fame, where she accused a cleric of behaving inappropriately with her. And I really started to consider the idea of what happens when a woman takes a man in power to account. How does that play out in certain places? What are the conversations that we're having about those sorts of issues? How do they get resolved? What does accountability look like? And that's the stuff I'm hoping to touch on in the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it'll be interesting.
You've been here just over a week. You have an interesting vantage point because just before you left for the U.S., the U.S. exited Pakistan's neighbor, Afghanistan, after a 20-year war. I wonder, how big was the news in Pakistan of that exit? And what are your countrymen and women seeing as the implications for your country?
The news was huge, and it was pretty terrifying to witness when American forces left Afghanistan, and you're seeing these people who have almost been sort of underground or been waiting for their moment to come in, and you have a blueprint for how they have behaved before, how they've governed before. And there really was a question of, okay, what happens now? And it was quite terrifying. I think some of the images that all of us were seeing, they were awful, pictures of planes taking off, people clinging to planes. I think it's very scary to consider that just across our border, there is this growing sentiment of policing, particularly women, how they should live, dress, work, and the gains that they've had in the past couple of years, what it looks like when that's taken away and how easily that can be taken away. And I think within Pakistan as well, when you do see a lot of people supporting that sort of new government in Afghanistan now, that is terrifying to consider, and the ways in which religious extremism is growing in our own country.
Is there a Taliban in Pakistan as well?
Yes, there is. Yes, yeah. We have our own.
Mm. Let's finish up on a hopefully up note. You've been in Iowa just over a week. What are your first impressions? Have you been to Iowa before?
I haven't been before. This is my first time here. And I have to say, it's my first week. And something that really struck me is this year is so different. Our group has also been halved. We have half the writers this year and half next year. And I think it's incredible to come to a place where after the year that all of us have had, where I think we were mostly in survival mode, to come to a place where suddenly you're told, this is your time to just think, to read, to focus on this creative pursuit, and to have the space and the freedom to do that. It feels so luxurious right now. That's the only word I can, I keep coming back to it. And to sort of, Iowa, I come from a city of 20 million, and I'm here right now, and it feels like wonderful to just, I feel like I'm in a small neighborhood of Karachi where it's quiet. You're never in a crowd. You're sort of, it's very much you're in a bubble and you're told that this is just your time to produce something or to consider the world around you. And I think particularly in the past year, how we've all been living and being sort of very isolated, it feels wonderful to come to a place where you're told, okay, it's not just your job to survive. Like, this is where you thrive. This is where you consider other things and not just the day-to-day basics of disinfecting things or whatever.
Yeah. Wow. That is a stark difference. And we wish you all the best. Peace and quiet or whatever you wish, or interaction, a lot of noise in the certain way with the other writers, the other 17 writers who are in residency, whatever it takes to get those creative juices going. We wish for you, Sanam. Thank you very much for this conversation. Sanam Maher, a nonfiction writer, journalist from Pakistan, author of A Woman Like Her. Thank you so much for this conversation. We wish you well for your time here in Iowa.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, Sanam Maher from Pakistan, just one of the 18 established writers from around the world currently in Iowa, taking part in this residency at the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Let's turn to the program's director, Christopher Merrill, poet, author, essayist. He directs this program, has been at the helm of the program for over 20 years. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Nice to see you, Ben.
We just heard such an interesting conversation from Sanam Maher from Pakistan, talking about the challenges she's faced as a journalist in that astounding book that she's written. Quickly introduce us to some of the other writers now in Iowa taking part in this residency.
Well, it really is a range of incredible talents coming from all around the world. Some of the writers that I'm thinking about today, the Algerian poet, essayist, playwright, translator, scholar, editor, Habib Tangour, who will be reading during the Iowa City Book Festival with his very longtime friend and one of the first members of the IWP from Luxembourg, Pierre Joris, who has just completed 53-year-long project of translating the great German poet Paul Celan. So we have writers like that. We have reading this afternoon the Israeli playwright Sarah Blaum, a Lithuanian poet named Gabriela Labanetskaya, and then a writer from Côte d'Ivoire, Edwige René Drou. We have a Burmese poet and screenwriter coming. We have Sanam, as you mentioned. We have writers from Lithuania, from South Korea, from Mexico, from Hong Kong, writers from around the world who in one way or another are not only doing exemplary work, but find themselves living in somewhat complicated circumstances, as indeed we all are during the time of COVID.
Right. And we at the residency of your program fell to the side as so many things were canceled in 2020. So what have been the challenges of making this year's residency work in the midst of what is still a pandemic?
Well, it has drawn on all of our improvisatory skills, I can say that, from trying to figure out how to get visas with embassies and consulates largely closed down, to itineraries that will take writers through places where they will be safe, and then to try to arrange readings and public panels, the sorts of things that have been the staple of the IWP all these years, to do it in a way that's safe. And we had our first reading in the Shambaugh House the other night since lockdown. It was a fantastic Chilean writer visiting the Spanish and Portuguese department. And I thought, my gosh, this is what it used to be like. And this is what it will be like once again, albeit smaller, with masks on and socially distanced.
Mm-hmm. Are there also virtual events?
Well, every reading that we do will be virtual as well. There will be a virtual piece to it so that we don't overcrowd Shambaugh House or the library. We want to make sure that people will be able to tune in to hear what the writers are saying and reading, but to do so in such a way that they won't chance getting sick.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us how people can find out more, perhaps turn out for an in-person event in a safe way, or tune in, listen to a virtual event. How do people find out more?
Well, if you go to our website, iwp.uiowa.edu, you'll find the biographies of all the writers. You'll see a schedule for when they will be appearing. Generally speaking, we have readings every Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Shambaugh House. And starting next week, we will have a reading panel discussions at the Iowa City Public Library at noon. So those are sort of constants in the programming for the fall. But if you start clicking around on the website, you'll find all the other really interesting things that we've been doing. For example, we hosted virtual writing programs over the summer for high school students from 20 different countries, another virtual program for college students from India, Pakistan, and the United States, all of which has been recorded. There are readings everywhere. Our archives are extensive, and it really feels good to be adding to those archives beginning this afternoon.
Well, we're glad to have you back safely. The residency of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, its director, Christopher Merrill, always wonderful to catch up with you, and glad that you're coping. You and your crew are coping with the pandemic and enriching our cultural life here in Iowa so much. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, that practically ends the News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on this October 8th. Time enough, though, always on our Friday News Buzz edition to groove into the weekend. In this case, with Mark Simmet, IPR Studio One host. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. I'm looking at my screen. A couple of really exciting tunes you have. You're going way back for this first one. What do you have?
Yeah, actually, this song has an interesting history. It's from David Bowie, the late David Bowie, one of my favorite artists. A song that he recorded in the year 2000 that is being released officially for the first time on its as a part of the album it was intended to be on. This will be coming out next year, so this is an advanced track from that project. But the song itself goes back actually to 1966, a very young David Bowie, before he had even chosen that name. He was still going by David Jones at that point. He wrote this song, re-recorded it in 2000, and now coming out on this album called Toy in early 2022. So a lot of dates involved with this song. It's just such a great pop song. When I heard it again, and I had heard it before, reminded me of, you know, Bowie's not exactly known for pop songs per se, but in this case, this is a great one. Simple pop song, very simply constructed, almost Beatlesque actually when you listen to it. And it's called You've Got a Habit of Leaving.
Hard to believe that David Bowie has been gone for some 5 years now. There's from the unreleased album Toy, You've Got a Habit of Leaving. Mark Simmet, we have time enough for one more.
Well, this is something brand new from Jose Gonzalez, who is an artist based in Sweden. He has a new album called Local Valley, And we always talk on these segments about music to end a busy news week. This record and this song would certainly fit that bill. It starts out with a pastoral scene and then some gentle acoustic strumming and the soothing voice of Jose Gonzalez with a song called Visions.
Visions, trying to make sense of a now, trying to make sense of a past, to show us how.
Beautiful. Nice selection, Mark. Visions from the new album Local Valley by Jose Gonzalez. Mark, all the best to you and the others at our Studio One facilities, and you have a great weekend. Thank you. We'll go out with Jose Gonzalez. Take care, Mark.
Thanks, Ben.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
With no one to praise or blame. Ooh.
Avoidable suffering and pain. We are patiently itching away toward unreachable utopias.